Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by, and welcome to the Riverstone Energy Limited half-year results. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. There will be a presentation followed by a question-and-answer session, at which time, if you wish to ask a question, you will need to press star and one on your telephone. I must advise you that this conference is being recorded today, Wednesday, the 29th of July, 2015. I would now like to hand the conference over to your first speaker, Kevin Ryan. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you very much, and good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to our half-year results call for the period ending June 30th, 2015. Thank you for joining us. My name is Kevin Ryan, as the operator mentioned, and I'm joined by Alfredo Marchi on the call. I'm pleased to report that Riverstone has continued to make good progress during the first half of 2015. I'm going to walk you through some of the key financial and operational highlights before handing over to Alfredo, who will elaborate a little bit more on the current portfolio in more detail, and then we'll take your questions at the end. The lower oil price environment has presented and continues to present significant opportunities for Riverstone. At the end of the third quarter last year, before the OPEC meeting, which accelerated the collapse in oil prices, we had invested just $199 million of the $1.2 billion we raised at the time of the IPO. Since then, obviously, oil and gas companies with strained balance sheets have been forced to significantly rein in capital spending plans and, in many cases, take on new capital or dispose of high-quality assets. Even the majors and large independents have responded by deferring activity and rationalizing their portfolios, not insignificantly. Given our strong capital position, along with the 14 management teams we have operating on the ground running our portfolio companies, this has enabled us to take advantage of what we believe are attractive valuations across a broad footprint of E&P and midstream opportunities in North America and elsewhere. During the first half of the year, we made five commitments to new companies and two add-on commitments to existing investments for a total of $580 million of new capital committed. Of the five new portfolio companies, four are led by repeat Riverstone management teams, which, of course, is a cornerstone of our investment strategy. We also made Riverstone's first midstream investment and created Riverstone Credit Opportunities to take advantage of the episodic dislocations in the energy credit market. That's something that occurred in January and February of this year and appears to be reoccurring again at the moment, given the current volatility in the oil price. As of 30th of June 2015, Riverstone had committed capital totaling $1.3 billion to 15 different portfolio companies. That equates to 107% of total capital raised. Of this, $556 million has been invested, equating to 46% of total capital raised. The five new capital commitments during the period are focused on the North American upstream and midstream sectors, which is, of course, the heart of our business. They include $125 million to Riverstone Credit Opportunities, or RCO, of which $50 million has been invested, $60 million to Kinara III, of which $1 million has been invested, $167 million to Three Rivers III, of which $3 million has been invested, $33 million to Meritage III, of which $7 million has been invested, and $33 million to Carrier II, of which $17 million has been invested. The additional commitments were to existing portfolio companies. We committed an extra $95 million to CIOC, bringing the total CIOC commitment to $155 million, and an extra $67 million to Rock Oil, bringing that total commitment to $150 million. All of these new commitments and investments were made alongside Riverstone's Funds 5 or 6 and at the standard 2-to-1 ratio, so no change from that. Alfredo will touch on these new portfolio companies in a little bit more detail in a few minutes. At 107% of capital raised, Riverstone has now committed slightly more capital than we raised at the time of the IPO. We believe that this is appropriate given, one, that individual portfolio companies can often reach their exit stage before investing their full capital commitment, and two, even when they invested fully, it can often take 24 to 36 months to do so. Therefore, we may see some parts of our full exits in advance, of approaching the full investment of Oriel's initial capital base. And additionally, our opportunistic investments through RCO are both very liquid in nature and relatively short-term in nature. So against that background, again, we feel the slight overcommitment is prudent. Our 10 existing, or pre-existing, investments, balancing conventional and unconventional onshore and offshore plays, are performing well. The lower oil price environment has provided opportunities for those teams to acquire additional assets and enter into farming transactions at what we believe are attractive valuations today. Some notable successes include CIOC, which has more than tripled production capacity since our initial investment, Fieldwood, which has achieved an 80% success rate on new wells drilled during the period, and Sierra, which you may have read about earlier this month, succeeded in securing two sought-after licenses in Mexico's first exploration licensing round. For the period, Oriel made a profit of just over $4 million, resulting in an NAV per share at the period end, 30th of June 2015, of $16.36 a share, an increase from $16 as of June 30th, 2014, and $16.31 as of December 31st, 2014. The increase in NAV over the last 6 months was primarily driven by the growth in fair market value of our investment in Rock Oil, which is now valued at 1.8 times our cost on the basis of recent transactions that have highlighted the value of the company's assets in the Midland Basin. We believe we are very well positioned for the current macro environment with a broad portfolio, significant uninvested capital, and a growing opportunity set. With that, I'd like to pass it over to Alfredo, who will talk you through the portfolio in a little bit more detail.
Thank you, Ken. So as of June 30th, Oriel's portfolio was comprised of 13 E&P investments, one midstream company, one credit investment, and $671 million of uninvested cash. We feel we continue to maintain a strong pipeline of opportunities in terms of first, the drilling inventory in our existing companies, bolt-on acquisitions available to those existing portfolio companies, and also additional potential commitments to new and existing management teams. I'll briefly take you through some material updates in our existing companies, which I will do only by exception, and then comment on the new companies that we have set up during the first half of the year. I'll start with CIOC, which is, as you know, is our largest investment, both in terms of invested capital and in terms of unrealized value. You'll remember that CIOC has aggregated one of the largest and most advantaged land positions in the emerging Montney and Duvernay plays in Western Canada Deep Basin. Over the last year, the company has been able to more than triple production capacity, which is now well over 10,000 barrels a day, and they've done that by drilling highly productive wells at attractive costs through operational efficiencies such as pad drilling. The drilling activity and production growth is expected to continue actively during the second half of the year and in 2016, in parallel to new investment in midstream infrastructure, which I'll come back to in a moment. We continue to be very enthusiastic about this place in general, the Montney and Duvernay, and more specifically about CIOC's position and performance in them. In fact, during the second quarter of the year, as Ken mentioned, we more than doubled our commitment to CIOC from $60 million to $155 million. And as of the end of last month, we have invested a total of $115 million in it from Oriel through a mix of primary and secondary transactions. After these transactions, between Fund 5 and Oriel, we collectively own approximately 40% of the common equity of CIOC, and we additionally own a substantial amount of convertible securities. These investments, the aggregate investment in CIOC is now marked at 1.3 times the premium to cost. Next, I'll touch on Rock Oil, which you may also remember is another E&P company led by a very successful onshore U.S. team. We reported in the last call that in the fourth quarter of 2014, they acquired just over 13,000 net acres in Howard County in the Midland Basin in Texas. And earlier this year, they began test drilling this acreage with the expectation of coming into production imminently in the second half of 2015. This particular acreage has increased substantially in value over the last few months in spite of the decline in oil prices, as evidenced by comparable transactions in the vicinity. And as a result of that mark-to-market, Our valuation on the investment has moved to 1.8 times cost. Additionally, this company, Rock Oil, is in advanced stages of progressing another material acquisition, and in support of this, we have increased our commitment to Rock from $83 million to $150 million. All of these numbers are net to REL. It's also appropriate, going back to Ken's initial remarks, to give you a bit more detail on what's happening with Sierra, the company that we established to participate in the historic opening of Mexico's oil and gas industry. Some of you may know that earlier this month, the Mexican government ran their first tender for EMP licenses, and this is one of four or five different tenders that are part of what they call round one. And this one was focused specifically on the shallow waters of the very prolific Sureste Basin in the Gulf of Mexico. Sierra participated in this tender in partnership with Premier Oil and with fellow rivers and portfolio company Talos Energy. And this consortium, we're happy to report that won the right to explore the two blocks that it bid for, and it did so prevailing very narrowly over competing bids by the likes of Statoil, ENI, and Hunt Oil. It's early days still for Sierra, but it's a great start. The investment still held at cost. Several oil portfolio companies took advantage of the commodity environment during the first half of the year to grow their asset base inorganically. That includes, for example, Liberty, which acquired 15,000 net acres in the Powder River Basin. Fieldwood made two acquisitions of Gulf of Mexico packages from supermajors. And Origo completed three farm-ins in the Norwegian and UK North Sea. All of these investments are marked at cost as of June 30th, except for Fieldwood, which continues to be held at 1.2 times cost. However, rather than focusing on these smaller transactions, I'd rather take a few minutes to walk through the five new companies that we established since our last call. This is two Canadian companies, two onshore U.S. companies, and the credit vehicle. So starting from the north, last April, we established Meritas 3, which is our first midstream investment in REL. As you know, we've had a number of midstream investments in Riverstone, but this is the first one in the REL portfolio. This company, Meritas, provides oil and gas producers with a full complement of midstream services. We're talking about, for example, gas processing facilities, oil and gas gathering lines, and other transportation facilities, etc. And it's initially focused on the same Western Canadian plays that are being successfully developed by CIOC and CNR. This is our second partnership with Steve Huckabee and the rest of the Meritage team. We have so far made an initial commitment of $33 million from Mariel, which is tagged specifically to building and operating gathering and processing infrastructure under a 10-year take-or-pay contract with CIOC. So you see two of our portfolio companies cooperating very beneficially. So this particular piece of infrastructure will support the expansion of CIOC's production while offering Merit as a minimum volume commitment ahead of securing other third-party clients. Within the same region, earlier this year we partnered with Paul Charon and his team for the third time to establish Canera 3, which is focused on the acquisition and efficient exploitation of conventional oil and gas assets in the Western Canadian Sedimentary Basin. We have a $60 million commitment to Canera 3, but they have yet to complete the first transaction. Similarly, in the U.S., we established two new companies focused on the Greater Permian Basin, in both cases backing repeat Riverstone management teams. The first of those was done in April when we established Three Rivers 3, with a $500 million commitment, of which $167 million come from REL. They have an emphasis on building and consolidating material operated positions in the basin, which they have done successfully twice for us. Then a month later in May, we created Carrier 2, with a $100 million commitment, of which $33 million come from REL, to pursue a slightly different strategy, one of being an influential non-operator, partnering and providing capital to top-tier operators in the basin, and with a specific focus on the Midland area. In line with this strategy, they already executed a first joint venture agreement with a highly experienced operator group made up of Henry Resources and PT Petroleum. According to this agreement, Carrier acquired a 30% working interest in a licensed position representing just over 19,000 net contiguous acres in the southern Midland Basin, so specifically in the Reagan, Upton, and Crockett counties. Last but not least, earlier this year we created RCO, as Ken mentioned, to take advantage of dislocations in the energy market, which have resulted from the oil price volatility. RCO is advised by Riverstone's internal credit investment team, which is led by Chris Abbott and Jamie Grotsky, but also seeks to leverage the Riverstone investment teams who have specific first-hand insights into the performance and prospectivity of oil and gas assets across North America, given that we have positions, as you know, in most producing basins in both U.S. and Canada. RCO has so far made 7 investments, which total $50 million, including 3 primary and 4 secondary transactions. And on a mark-to-market basis, we hold these investments at 1.1 times cost. So with that, I'd like to pass you back to Ken for closing remarks and then Q&A.
Thanks, Alfredo. As we said a couple of times already, we think the current opportunity set in the energy sector is as robust as it's been on the investment side for a very long time. Oriel has made significant strides over the last 6 months investing in high-quality companies in partnership with very strong management teams, and more often than not, management teams that we have partnered with successfully in the past with previous portfolio companies. We continue to use moderate leverage. We continue to hedge as much as possible in order to ensure resilience across the commodity cycle. And I think probably most significantly, we are in a very strong capital position. So while we have committed about $1.3 billion of capital, we still have $671 million of cash available to invest. So this is not in any way signed up or invested today. It is truly dry powder. And this significant firepower and agility to take advantage of the flow of opportunities generated by our extensive existing asset footprint and our management teams gives us confidence as we go forward. As I say, we're very pleased with the progress and confident the company will continue to perform strongly for shareholders. So with that, I think we'd like to open the floor to any questions that you may have.
Thank you. As a reminder, if you wish to ask a question, please press star and one on your telephone and wait for your name to be announced. If you wish to cancel your request, please press the hash key. So that is star and one to ask a question. Okay, your first question comes from the line of Joseph Mares. Please go ahead.
Hi, thanks for having the call, and thanks for doing what you said you would do 2 years ago. I just had two quick points I want to make. First of all, I guess, can you just clarify, I mean, you mentioned moderate leverage. Do you have a sort of an aggregate figure of the amount of debt at the on the company level? Sort of back to REL. I mean, the only place I thought there was a little bit of debt at Fieldwood, some other places. I don't know if you've ever kind of given that number or an update there. The second thing I just wanted to get your thoughts on was, it's difficult for us to see, but what's the level of private equity activity outside of what you guys are doing over the last 3 to 4 months in the sectors you're involved in? I mean, have other people been committing capital generally at the same pace that you have? And the third point, just to clarify, given your commitment level, basically what you have in terms of management teams is basically what it's going to be. You're not still looking to add other investment groups. I guess you're now in the process, basically the management team is committing or spending the capital that you've allocated them. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Joe. Thanks for the question. Thanks for joining. So I'm going to answer your question in a not even in reverse order, in a little bit of a jumbled order. Taking your second point with respect to activity levels, I think I'm not sure if we're operating at a different pace to other private equity firms. I would tell you that we are seeing a lot of flow, but there continues to be a little bit of a gap, I think, between price expectations of sellers and what we are willing to pay. I think the experience is probably not dissimilar with respect to other firms. I know Blackstone said on a call early in the year that, you know, their energy team was working 24/7 on deal opportunities, and then they had a subsequent call where they said none of those opportunities came to pass. And I feel like we're maybe not dissimilar to that. The caveat probably for us is because we have this platform in place, i.e. we have the teams in place, there's a lot of, there's a lot of activity below the surface at maybe more of a micro level in our portfolio that some of the other private equity firms maybe don't have the same platform or breadth of management teams. I think I think that gap between the buyers and sellers is closing as volatility continues, but we're still, that gap still exists today. So maybe activity level is not quite as high as we might have expected. Taking your third point with respect to committing to new teams, we are fully committed. I think we are 95% of our focus now is on making sure that we invest the remaining cash, almost $700 million, prudently across the portfolio in hopefully very good opportunities. We new teams may come along. I think it's going to be hard for us to commit to them given our current capital position, but we're not. I don't think we're in any way concerned by that. I think we're extremely well positioned where we sit today. And then finally, with respect to leverage, we haven't ever aggregated a sort of a net number with respect to REL. We may have to come back to you on that, but to give you some sense, there's really only maybe four companies that have any leverage at all out of the 15. And I think the leverage ranges from about 1.6 times run rate EBITDA to about, a little over 3 times, maybe touching 4 in one instance. But in aggregate, I'd have to come back to you in aggregate dollars, but it's pretty low.
Okay, great. Thanks again. Thanks for time.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Anish Kapadia. Please go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon. Just three questions from me. I think clearly there's more investments available in this market, and you kind of made the point of bid asks still being somewhat wide. I just wanted to kind of get an idea of, it seems like you're seeing kind of different markets having more or less value, some kind of bifurcation over there. What are the areas within North America and outside of North America that you're kind of seeing value emerge now? The second question is to do with the capital that you have. You've really committed the full amount of cash on the balance sheet. Just wondering about how you think about the amount of capital within Riverstone going forward. Are you considering, or when will you consider increasing the amount of capital that will be within Riverstone? And are you going to wait to get to be fully committed, or could you look to do that at an earlier date so you could kind of then bring more investments in this environment? And then the final thing was, just wanted to see if you could kind of reflect on the returns that you're targeting and what we've seen so far. So I suppose as an investor, if you're an investor in Riverstone Energy from the start around 2 years ago, the share price in dollar terms would be pretty flat. Relative to you targeting the 20 to 30% returns, just wondering how you kind of reconcile the two and how you see that, how confident you are on that return profile going forward in a lower price environment, even though you say that you don't really take the commodity price bets. There's some detailed questions that I appreciate your answers.
Sure, yeah. Thanks, Anish. I'll hit some of these, and Alfredo will comment on one or two as well. But in terms of what areas within North America, I'll deal with that. I'll let Alfredo deal with that side of North America. Within North America, we see, and I suppose I'll deal with U.S. and Canada, within North America where we see opportunities. I'm not sure there's any particular area that we are maybe more focused on than others. With one caveat, I would say that we are probably more focused on the major basins as opposed to the periphery basins. So where there's big resource, deep resource, we're quite focused, and we're just looking at a lot of different opportunities. But nothing today stands out in terms of there being a disproportionate value proposition as compared to others.
The only thing I would add to that is that you always have to remember that we're much more micro players and macro. So the areas where you see us deploying more capital tend to be the large basins where we have a real depth in terms of management teams, being able to force proprietary transactions and so on. Factually, you've seen that just in the last 6 months we've made two investments in the Permian, where we already had an existing management team. So clearly that's an example of an area where I wouldn't necessarily say that from a macro level there's a bargain to be had, but it's an area which is there's abundant opportunity, very heterogeneous assets, so a lot of value to be kind of discovered and created. And we have a real depth in our bench in terms of ability to operate in places like that. We're developing the same thing in Western Canada, so you'll see us being driven more by that type of on-the-ground ability to execute than by sort of macro M&A trends. And then internationally, I would say we're in this commodity environment, we're being extremely cautious about what we take on in terms of large offshore infrastructure projects, etc. I'll tell you that in this portfolio, Origo is having very good traction in Norway, for example. Obviously, exploration budgets are being slashed across the piece, so it is a very fertile ground for them to pick off the top of the vintage of exploration wealth across the basin, and we are happily being able to be extremely extremely selective in the things that we take on.
That may be a good segue into your third question, Anish, which is the one with respect to returns. So I think, at the time of the IPO, we said we're targeting 20-30% gross IRRs before performance reallocation. Where we sit today, I don't think there's any reason we don't see any reason to sort of change that target. Cutting to the quick of the matter, we were very fortunate in that we hadn't invested any kind of a material amount of money when the oil price started to fall out of bed. But we were fortunate that we had a lot of management teams sort of set up and in place. So we're able, I think, to take advantage of the dislocation today. And we like the investments we have. I think the share price performance, obviously is flat since the IPO, but I think relative to the energy sector, certainly as a whole, it's performed very strongly, and maybe that's some sort of recognition that we that our timing has been fortunate in that regard. And I think if you look at the investments today, we're not in any way investing betting on a a particular oil price outcome over the medium to long term. I think it's sort of business as usual in terms of how we think about making these investments, which is with an industrial mindset to improve operations and just grow production and grow proved resources. And finally, with respect to capital, right now we have no plans to raise more capital. I think we have our hands full with a very good portfolio. We still have a bunch of money to put to work, so we are 100% focused on that.
Just have one quick follow-up. In terms of your portfolio companies at the moment, do you see all your assets working at current strip pricing?
Sorry, I misheard that. Anish, would you mind repeating it?
Sure. Yeah. Just in terms of your current portfolio, in terms of your portfolio companies, do you see all their assets working at strip pricing, or are there any that you think will struggle if the strip comes to pass over the next 5 years?
Yeah, no, the short answer, Anish, is that we're very happy to say yes. As Ken mentioned at the beginning of his remarks, you have to remember that the vast majority of the assets that we currently have in the portfolio were actually acquired at roughly the current oil price environment and strip. The two assets that we acquired, material assets that we acquired before the decline in oil prices are Fieldwood and the initial piece of Liberty. In the case of Fieldwood, we're very confident that the company work obviously doesn't make as much money at the current strip as it did last year, but it's in very strong footing, and the amount of sort of operational improvement that we're seeing there in terms of new oil and gas being discovered with 80% success rate in the last 6 months, in terms of trimming the fat from the previous operators and being able to leverage synergies from being sort of by far the natural consolidator of the play. When you put all of that together, Fieldwood is in a very strong position. And Liberty, you may remember that we did make a significant acquisition at the beginning of last year, but then before the oil price collapsed, we did a swap where we divested all of the non-core acreage. We took some money off the table, paid down debt. So Liberty is also in a very strong position financially. I mean, having said all of that, of course we do manage this particular asset basis very carefully, and there are times in our portfolio where we might say, well, I won't drill 100 wells in the inventory, but this trip I'll only drill 70 or 50. But that is kind of measures of a different scale of opportunity ahead of us, as opposed to any current assets being compromised.
Great. Thanks very much.
Once again, please press star and one if you wish to ask a question on the phone. And your next question comes from the line of Fred Lucas. Please go ahead.
Thank you, and good afternoon, guys. A few questions. Can you just confirm that the investments that you have made and will make, Riverstone has full management control over the vehicles? And as a kind of subordinated question to that, I wonder if you could expand on how that management control is manifesting now. Are the teams that you have in place and the assets they have to invest in, are they exercising greater caution and delay in their investments? We're hearing from the big oil companies through the Q2 results season how they're still basically pushing back, deferring, given the deflationary wave that they expect to build and perhaps peak not until 2016. The second question is, and I know you're probably focused more on getting your capital invested rather than realizations for the moment, but given how this price cycle and the asset cycle is shaking down this time around, are you having to think about longer holding periods and pushing back exits and realization events on your portfolios? And the third question, if I may, is which of your investments are closest to being at risk of impairment? We're still seeing a pretty steady stream of impairments coming from the all majors through this set of numbers, and I expect more will follow. So I just wondered where within your portfolio investments you would see the assets to be at greatest risk of triggering impairment, perhaps near term. Thank you.
Great, thanks, Fred. So we'll sort of take these in order. With respect to full management control, in all instances, we either have absolute control, i.e., we own the vast majority of the company, or in the case of the CIOC, just to take one example, we have pretty significant negative controls. So we don't, in that particular example, own a majority of the company, but we are the largest individual shareholder. We own pretty close to the majority, and the shareholders' agreement give us all the controls we require to exercise our investment strategy in the normal course. And that's obviously very important to us, and particularly important in environments like this where it's volatile, or the market's volatile. In terms of how that control manifests itself in today's environment, I would say two points. One, we are very aligned with our management teams, and by that I mean all of our management teams invest, you know, actual dollars and cents in the companies alongside us. So they write checks when we write checks. Those checks tend to be, you know, putting aside the absolute dollar size of those checks, they tend to be very material to the, you know, to the net worth of the management team. So it's rare for us to be forcing a team to do something that they already haven't concluded is a good thing to do themselves. Whether it's, you know, scale back CapEx, or even for a number of our teams today, pursue opportunities somewhat aggressively given the environment we're in. But I think the whether we're doing one or the other is sort of case by case relative to the strategy the team is pursuing, how much capital they have available, and what's happening to the assets they own if they own some already. With respect to longer hold periods, I think it's for this particular portfolio, it's too early to predict whether we'll end up holding some of these assets longer or shorter than we typically hold. I think across our portfolio since the start of our firm over 15 years ago, the average hold period is about 36 months, and that's sort of a weighted average hold period. So if we invest over time, you get a weighted average of your in-date and your out-date based on capital in and capital out. It's too early to say if this portfolio will be, you know, will end up being inside that or outside that. We're in, you know, quite the early innings, obviously, of investing this capital. You know, almost $400 million of the 600 odd or 550 we've invested in the last 6 months or 7 months. So we're at the very early stages, and we've another, you know, 2.5 plus years to go to hit that, you know, to hit that average. And then finally, you know, which of these is closest to impairment? I don't think that's a question we're in a position to answer today. I mean, we value these assets on a quarterly basis. We have gone through three valuations now post the OPEC meeting in November, and they've all held pretty steady. You know, costs are coming down pretty dramatically, so I think we feel pretty good about where we are today.
And just a follow up to that, Ken. Thanks for the answers. When you do those impairments tests, do you run that down, as it were, atomistically to the asset level? And when you do so, do you look at do you form groups, as it were? So what I'm trying to answer, as we see in the oil industry, is they sometimes form asset groups, and part of the asset group is in surplus and part in deficit, and therefore they avoid an impairment as a result. I just wondered the mechanics of your impairment testing.
Well, I'm not sure. What we do is a mark-to-market valuation. So I think it's slightly different from a classic oil and gas company. We have to follow the investment company guidelines from an accounting perspective. So we essentially do a mark-to-market of each asset or each portfolio company at the particular date. And that mark-to-market involves a variety of market valuation tests, including comparable publicly listed companies, recent M&A transactions or asset transactions, DCF analysis, PV10 analysis, et cetera.
Right.
And the valuation committee meets on a quarterly basis, goes portfolio company by portfolio company, looks at all the data, and then comes up with a valuation, and then on a semi-annual basis, our auditors EY test those valuations. So at the year end, those valuations are audited by EY, and at the half year, they are reviewed. I think is the technical term, but that review is a long and in-depth process. Where they go again, they almost go asset by asset. I mean, they don't look at all 15 because a number of them are, you know, there's $1 million or $2 or $3 million invested, but the material investments and the ones that are marked other than cost, they do an in-depth review of and confirm or otherwise our valuation.
Got it. Very clear. Thanks, Ken.
And we don't seem to have any more questions at this point, sir.
Okay, well, thank you, everybody, for taking the time to join us. Alfredo and I are always available if you have follow-up questions, but have a nice rest of the day, and we'll see you all soon, I hope.
Thank you.
That does conclude the conference for today. Thank you for participating. You may now disconnect.